Bible prophecy, but even amongst the people that see this as a direct a direct reference to Israel being reborn, which once again, prior to 1948, nobody thought this. Nobody thought there ever would. Well, a few Bible scholars did, but most of them looked at most of this as pure allegory that would have no place in reality. But amongst those that do see this as a picture of Israel being reborn, the confusion lies over the word generation, which, and I find it, I was going to say pathetic, but that's not fair, because some of the men who've done this are smarter than I am, and I respect them, but it's, I think it's foolish to pick a day and predict a day that Jesus is going to return. I think verse 36 ought to shut that whole thing down. He says, nobody knows the specific day or hour except the Father. But the language of the whole chapter is talking about times and seasons. I mean, we should be aware of those. But the exact specific day. But people can't resist. Like I said, one of my very favorite Bible teachers calculated out the length of a generation to being 51.4 years. So he added 1948 to 51.4, and you know what it came out to? It came out to, on the dot, the year 2000, Jesus is going to come back for his church. It's really interesting to see how he tries to explain that now 10 years later, because it didn't happen. He's covered his tracks in one respect by saying, and I do not say this disrespectfully, but he's covered his tracks by saying we're living on borrowed time. It should have happened 10 years ago. But I think the whole problem is sidestepped if you just look at the word for generation. Because the Greek word is a broad word. The word is genea, spelled G-E-N-E-A. It may mean a group of contemporaries, the way we use it. And that's the problem. Looking at the things that Jesus said with the 21st century American brain and then trying to translate that word generation. But remember, often, Jesus used the word generation, in at least in the Greek translation of what Jesus said in Aramaic. The word generation can simply mean a group of like-minded people or a group that participates in the same event. A lynch mob could fit into the word genea. It may also be translated, and there are a number of people that do it this way, it may be translated race. If that's the case, Jesus could be saying, this race of people that in a few years is going to look like it ceased to exist, and for a couple of thousand years is going to look like it's only a matter of time, it'll peter out. He says, no, it's not going to pass away until every one of these details that I've told you about is fulfilled. If that were the case, that would be very compelling, because Israel came back from near oblivion. I mean, a couple times people have tried to wipe them from the face of the earth. There's a bunch of people that would like to wipe them from the face of the earth right now. Somebody's trying really hard to get nuclear weapons to do that very thing. They've sworn to do it. Will they be successful? Not if you believe God's word. That tactical nuclear device or that warhead's going to have to pass through God's promise before it fulfills its goal. But I think the whole problem here is resolved. And this is my personal belief. You don't have to believe everything that I do about it. I've been studying this for 40 years. I'm more convinced than I ever have. First, to not pick a day, but to recognize the times and the seasons. And the whole passage we're looking at today, Jesus is saying, you need to be in a posture of paying attention and being ready if you fall into this category, and I think we do. My belief is that when he used the word genea for generation, he's talking about the group of people who see the reformation of Israel as a nation. The fig tree, as it were, after looking dead and dormant, once again coming to life. And I would think that would apply to us today. And that's the way I view it. It could be that the Jewish race won't pass away, and I've heard some really good Bible teachers say that. Either way, all the others, here's the compelling thing. I'm trying to tie all this together. Remember the 2 weeks ago when we looked at labor pains? The greater the frequency, the greater the intensity, you know, that the birth is near. Labor pains do not go on indefinitely. There's a point at which the birth happens. It was a great example for Jesus to use. And remember, he talked about the pestilences and earthquakes and, oh, come on, help me, famines. There's four, and I did totally. Wars and rumors of wars. Once again, frequency and intensity. Never has there been in the history, recorded history of the earth, all of these events to the degree and the frequency that they're happening today. There's actually geological reasons for some of these things. The shifting of the tectonic plates of the earth, a lot of the destruction of topsoil layers, corruption in northern Africa where 40 million people starved to death in a 4-year period, and there was plenty of food simply because of political corruption. All of those things happening to the degree that they are today, coincidentally, within a 50-year or 60-year period where I'm still alive, having seen the nation Israel in a miraculous way become a nation in their own homeland after surviving for 2 millennia without their own homeland and still remain as a contiguous people, culturally in every other way. The fact that all of those things align would tell me that's not a coincidence, and that's why I have seen this parable, the way Jesus told it, as fitting in with everything else that he's talked about. I want to insert John 14 right here, and let's flip over there because I want to talk about the huppah. What Jesus is saying in this passage to the disciples, this is the good news, bad news passage, where he's telling them, I'm leaving. What? I'm leaving. Come on. You're going to be king. You're going to kick out the Romans. No, I'm leaving. But it's going to be better. I'm going to send you another comforter, he says in this passage, the same speech. But what he's saying to them in these few verses we read this morning is, I am not abandoning you. And then he uses a phrase that would make perfect sense to these Jewish boys. Doesn't make as much sense to us 21st century Gentiles, as I said. But he uses the picture from the Jewish wedding tradition. In a Jewish wedding, there are two primary stages. The first stage is called betrothal. Well, at least in Jesus' day, there are variations of it today. But thinking with their minds, the guys he's talking to, this example would have been thrilling. It made perfect sense. The betrothal period was a legal binding contract. We don't have anything like it. We call it the same as engagement, but it's really not. You couldn't end a betrothal without getting a divorce. You couldn't just throw the ring in his face and saying, you dirt clod, I'm never going to marry you. I hate your guts. You would have to get a divorce because the betrothal was a binding contract. It was a binding contract in the same way that putting earnest money down on a piece of property was a binding contract. In fact, the couple that were betrothed were viewed as married in every way except they had no sexual relationship. But in all other respects, they were treated as if they were already married. And that went on for a period of time. And some of that period of time depended on the preparation for the place that they were going to live. Let me look at my notes here and I can put it down in good words. There was a time when the groom went away, took time off, went, if they were a young couple, usually the place that he prepared for the bride and him to live was in dad's house somewhere or on dad's property. He would go away and he would prepare the place where they were going to live. He'd tell her, I'm going away. I'm getting our place ready. And of course, half of what made it exciting was you didn't know when he was going to come back. When everything was ready, he'd get all dressed up, he'd get on his horse, he would get all his friends together. There'd be a lot of noise. You'd hear Jewish party music, you know, Hava Nagila. And he would come literally riding to where the bride was, and he would literally scoop her up and carry her away. And the minute they got back to dad's house, the huppah would happen. That the ceremony, which is called huppah because that was the name for the canopy they got married under. So here's the guy getting... This is kind of interesting, isn't it? This is very, very different than the way we do it. The guy, knowing all of his bride-to-be's taste, goes and gets the place ready so that when she walks in, it's going to seem exactly like home. But there's this element of surprise. And of course, that picture, when Jesus said, you know, you don't want to be in your Red Sox sweats with your hair in curlers, when all of a sudden me and the boys come riding into town to whisk you off to the huppah, there's not going to be any chance to get ready then. So stay ready. Here's the point of him using that illustration. I love it. I think it's a great illustration. He's saying the guarantee that I'm coming back to get you is that I'm going away to prepare the place. Now, to every Jewish person, that would have been absolutely the clearest example you could have used. It gets lost, I think, on us, doesn't it? One of the first time that we taught this, Gwen just fell in love with that word, huppah. So every time I'd say her, she would say, huppah. And what she's saying is, it won't be long. We're going to get whisked away. Robin Hood's going to come riding into Nottingham on his white horse, and while Maid Marian is tied to the post up there, he's going to come and cut the things with one arrow and come and whisk her and carry her off. I love that picture. It was deliberate and unmistakable in John 14 that Jesus used that example, and what he's saying is, oh, no, I'm not abandoning you. The only reason I'm even going away is to get everything ready for the huppah. And they knew that he meant, that means I'm coming back. You know it means I'm coming back to get you, to carry you away, take you to be with me. Para lambano, or para, how do you pronounce it? Where's the emphasis on the para lambano? Okay, why did you read all of that, Bob, besides just it's a great romantic story? I like the whole guy riding in, whisking the woman away, and the horse thing. Because Jesus uses that same word twice. In Luke, he uses it three times, because Luke talks about two people being in the same bed, and one person whisked away, and the other person left behind. In this passage coming. So let's flip back over to 36 and hold that thought. By the way, I want to reiterate something that Jesus said in verse 35, because it is so opposite the way we look at things. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Focus is so important, and it is so hard. Do you know that we are the most distracted by information people that have ever lived on this earth? We are bombarded with information. Focus is the hardest thing to maintain. In fact, if you try to maintain focus, you feel irresponsible because there are way too many things to focus on. So you're going to have to leave something out. Classic example that I think fits into everything that Jesus said. Look at the way people were on 9/11 early in the morning. Look at the way people were on 9/12, and look at the way people are today. 9/11 in the morning, nobody had a clue what was about to happen. And of course, the unthinkable happened. Could have been way worse. If it had happened an hour later, when there would have been 50,000 people in those buildings, it would have been staggering. But the most interesting thing I've heard is the way people were the next day. I talked to a family that bought a business up here, and he worked in that building, and he was in one of the Twin Towers. He was one of the people that escaped. You know what he did the very next day? He completely changed his career. He grabbed his family. He moved as far away from any target zone as he could get. He moved way out in the sticks in Maine. Because he realized, I don't even know my kids. They almost lost me. His entire focus changed. It never would have changed had not those events happened. So he said, okay, it's all about my family from now on. You know how long that lasted? It lasted a couple of years and then got bored. And he moved back to New York, where everything had all settled down, got the same job that he had before. We have very short memories, don't we? So easy to get put after a catastrophe happens and all of a sudden we get real and we check our priorities and we change our focus. So easy for that to just be hypnotized and go right back to the same stuff we were in before. So that's, I think, the reason why Jesus says over and over, and next week we're going to see it a couple of more times. And the week after that, where Jesus is saying to these guys, be in a posture of paying attention. Watch. Be in a posture of being ready. Nobody knows, verse 36, nobody knows about that precise. The Greek means a precise, specific day and hour. I had to circle the verb knows. In the Greek, if you care, I mean, I care, I know Fred cares, it is present indicative, which is the same as saying nobody knows now, here and now. Action which has taken place while the speaker is speaking. So when Jesus said, remember, one of the questions they ask him is, when is all this stuff going to happen? And he's saying, well, that particular day, and what has he just referred to? Nobody knows right now, that day. Not the angels in heaven, not even the Son. And right now, Jesus is saying, that information is not being given to me. But the Father knows it right now. Last week, I said, the second coming of the Lord isn't going to come back and get his church. It's going to happen because of anything we do. It's a preset day. And I think Jesus backs that up here when he says, the Father knows right now when that's going to be. But I can't answer your question, he's saying, because standing here in my earthly body, I don't know. I used to do a rabbit trail that took several pages worth of notes about, does that mean that there was something that Jesus standing there in his earthly body didn't know that the Father knew? And the answer is, well, obviously that's true. Philippians chapter 2, this is not going to be that rabbit trail. This is sort of a rabbit turnout, not an actual trail. But Jesus in Philippians 2 says he self-limited himself. He laid aside aspects of his deity. He was still fully God, still fully man, but he limited himself. This is one of the ways he limited himself. Well, what about all those miracles? I don't know about you. My view of Jesus was like he was Superman, but he was dressed as Clark Kent. You know, when you're reading those comic books, you're thinking, come on. A pair of glasses, part in his hair on the other side. Can't you see who that is? It's not, I mean, they're the same people. I mean, especially, you know, Lois Lane and Perry White and Jimmy Olsen, they're around him all the time. Can't you see who this is? And I used to think, you know, Jesus in his earthly body was Clark Kent, and then, you know, he'd dash into a phone booth and leap tall buildings at a single bound. But in Hebrews, where it talks about Jesus as the author and the perfecter or finisher of our faith, and several things that Jesus himself said, he worked those miracles and did the things that he did exactly the same way he's asking you to live. Totally dependent upon his heavenly Father. He said, I only do the things he tells me to do, only to say the things he tells me to say. And of course, at one point, he looked at these very same guys and said, you know what? Greater things than what you've seen me do, you're going to do, because I'm going to be living in you, in the person of the Holy Spirit. So that's my little rabbit turnout. Jesus said, right now, I can't tell you that day, but Father knows. That's all you need to know. And then he uses another one of those sign examples. If you want to look at it in detail, I think it's worth looking at it, but it takes four chapters in Genesis 6 through 9. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. And then he makes a few comments. There's a surprising amount of detail in Genesis 6, 9 that describes the way things were. It's worth a look. I'll tell you what you'll find. If you can just put Evan Almighty out of your mind, which is not good theology in just about any way, although it was kind of a fun movie, but it's not theology, it's just a movie. If you can put some of maybe the movies that Cecil B. DeMille did that talk about this event, if you can put that stuff out of your head and just look at what it actually says in those four chapters in Genesis, it's surprising when you look at what Jesus said, that in the times that are right before I return, to catch away, snatch up my bride. It's going to be just like those days. It's interesting when you look then at Genesis that you're going to see how familiar those days look. As it was in the days of Noah, it will be in the coming man. Because in the days before the flood, people were eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, right up to the day Noah entered the ark. In other words, they were just living business as usual, as if everything was going to go on just the way that it was. And Noah builds a boat. No one had ever seen a boat that big. He's preaching for 120 years, telling them what's coming. And then it says, but nobody knew about what would happen until the flood came and took them away.